You are listening to Making Bank, where we uncover the mindset and success strategies of the top 1% so you can amplify your life and your business.
Welcome to Making Bank. I am Josh Felber, where we uncover the mindset and the success strategies of the top 1% so you can amplify your life and your business today. Super excited and honored for today's guest, Mark Polymeropoulos, retired in June 2019 from the Senior Intelligence Service ranks at the CIA. After a 26-year career in operational headquarters and field management assignments covering the Middle East, Europe, Eurasia, and counterterrorism. He has served in both Iraq and Afghanistan and is one of the CIA's most decorated field officers. Mark is the recipient of Distinguished Career Intelligence Medal, the Distinguished Intelligence Medal, and the Intelligence Medal of Merit, and the Intelligence Commendation Medal. His last position was overseeing CIA's Candlestein operations in Europe and Eurasia. He is a respected commentator on foreign policy and intelligence that matters and is widely quoted in both the U.S. and international media. I'm excited to welcome Mark to Making Bank.
Hey, Josh, thanks so much for being here. You know, that was a great introduction, and it sounds really fancy, but I'll tell you, you learn a little humility when you have a last name like mine. And I tell a story when I was in the Middle East one time back in early 2000s, George W. Bush was the president. His briefers were going downtown to see him, and they called me, and they wanted my view on something that was happening in the Middle East. So, I waited eagerly afterwards by the secure phone, and they came back a couple hours later, and I was like, all right, this is a big deal. Like, what did the president, you know, say about my analysis? And they said, well, we spent the whole time in the Oval Office trying to pronounce your last name. So you got it great. And, it's always been fun. No one ever forgets you. That's for sure.
Yeah, definitely. It's like, oh, wait, there's that Mark Pauly. And they remember either the name or they like it's anchored into them now.
I played ice hockey growing up and my jersey was like, you know, Polymeropoulos went like this. And so it was pretty funny. So.
That's cool. Well, I guess give us a little bit of background. I mean, I guess tell us a little about how you got started, what took you in the direction of the CIA and kind of spurred all this for you.
Sure. So, you know, I think I always kind of was destined for this job. I mean, I look back and I talk about it in my book on, you know, how I, you know, my journey, but when I was 10 years old, you know, and I think about this now because I have kids. When I was 10 years old, my mom put me on an airplane. My dad was a college professor. He was doing a sabbatical in Algeria. So at 10 years old, I flew from, Newark, New Jersey to Paris to Algeria by myself. And my dad and I then in a Volkswagen minibus for 1 month drove 2,000 miles through the Sahara Desert, sleeping in oases and stuff like that. So I fell in love with the Middle East. You know, I felt like I was Lawrence of Arabia. And so I think that's where I kind of fell in love with the region, but also that I wanted to do something, a little different. And, you know, when I was a kid, I read James Michener's book, Caravan, which was about a young foreign service officer in Afghanistan in the 1950s. And you know, it's really ironic that years later, when I was in Afghanistan, you know, with the CIA and we were in the middle of Helmand province and I'm sitting there cross-legged talking to a village elder trying to kind of negotiate to buy back a Taliban high value target. I thought back to that time when I read that book, when I was super young. So look, CIA was the only job I ever had, you know, right out of college. And I retired after 26 years where it was, I never had a dull day at the office.
Wow. That's awesome. So what, obviously going in the CIA is not super easy. Right. So I guess what were some of the challenges you knew ahead of time? Because obviously, 10 moving forward, you've kind of already had started to lay that roadmap, that plan of that path where you wanted to go. But what were some of those initial challenges that you had to overcome to be able to get it even in the door and then when you got started?
Sure. So, and this is a great question because so many people now, you know, I'm out in public, I'm talking about it. So a lot of college students ask me, how do I join the CIA or what do you look for? And I think, you know, that some of the traits that I had that I can now kind of tell others is it's pretty simple. It's, you know, one, you know, first of all, you have to be interested in other cultures, other people. You know, you join the CIA, you're not going to live in America. You know, I lived in the Middle East for many years. So you have to be interested in other cultures. You have to have this kind of sense of adventure where you're going to live in the third world. So you know what? You're not going to have power. You're not going to have electricity. You know, I have this like crazy phobia now of cockroaches because I lived in so many crappy places where there were the giant like man-eating roaches. And so, but ultimately it's a curiosity for the world. You know, you got to learn another language. You got to eat kind of funny food. And then the most important thing is just, you know, kind of a sense of patriotism because you really are at the tip of the spear and you got to want to, you know, you work for your country in a really unique job. But you know, but ultimately, you know, my old colleagues, the men and women are kind of regular folks. They just have those kind of key characteristics that made them want to join the, you know, the clandestine service.
That's awesome. And so kind of having those characteristics, if somebody's like, cool, I want to head down that path from a preparation standpoint, do they need to be physically a certain way? Do they need to, you know, have a certain IQ? Like, I guess what are, you know, some things that they can do to start planning that then to move that direction?
I think the key thing is you got to learn a foreign language, and it's going to be, okay. And sorry, it's not Spanish from high school or French.
Yeah.
You know, so it's hard target languages. It's like Russian or Arabic, Chinese, Farsi. And so it's languages that our adversaries use. And so to join the CIA and to work overseas as a CIA operations officer, you got to learn a foreign language. And so I think that's what, you know, I really kind of tell folks. The other thing, and I kind of equate this to, if you want to be a Navy SEAL, you got to know how to shoot a weapon. If you want to be a CIA case officer, you have to have some street smarts. You have to have a sense of, you know, situational awareness on the street, because when we go to meet someone for an operational meeting, you run what's called a surveillance detection route. So, you know, if you get lost all the time and you're bad with maps, or you're kind of walking around in a fog, like some people do, that might not be the career for you. So it's kind of a fundamental, a trait and characteristic that you need. I talk about it in my book because it's one of the processes that you have to master. And that's, you know, the ability to be street smart.
Definitely. No. And, you know, and I obviously now even we have the phones, but you probably don't want to be on your phone trying to follow a route or a map,
right?
Potentially, because then somebody could detect or track you or different things like that. So knowing how to read maps, I think, is huge. Right. I know I learned that in Boy Scouts growing up, and we don't really teach it much anymore.
Well, you know what? It's so funny you say that, and I tell you that because I was kicked out of Cub Scouts, but there's a lot of actually, you know, Boy and Eagle Scouts at the agency because of those kind of unique skills. It's also, and the other part too is, you know, an ability to operate on your own.
Right.
So, you know, that is a key part of life as an operations officer. You make decisions, and sometimes life and death decisions completely on your own. So you have to have that, you know, it's not only that confidence, but that kind of comfort level in doing so. And so, you know, that's, people always talk about, you know, Boy Scouts and Eagle Scouts. And again, I was kicked out of Cub Scouts, so I was an anomaly, but I'm not going to tell you why.
I made the Eagle Scout. So. No, that's great. You know, understanding the street smarts, you know, obviously, like you said, maps, being able to engage and do stuff. You know, and that's kind of like as an entrepreneur, I mean, a lot of times when you start a business, it's just you. You're doing everything. You're growing it. You're trying to figure out how to market. You're doing all that. And I know throughout your book and everything too, you talk about leadership. What are some of the ways, obviously, there's leadership. How does that translate over from the CIA and vice versa? What can we pull from that to use right, like in our business or from a leadership role as we're growing it up and working with others and everything?
Sure. So one of the things that you know, one of the reasons I think that my book is going to resonate and what I talk about so much is our ability as a CIA operations officer to operate in that gray, you know, when times are difficult. And just like in the business world, if the market's good, if you have a company and your sales are great, everything's fine. It's easy.
Right.
I'm talking about real life. So one thing that I found is I started to understand, you know, or have an ability of when there was a lack of situational awareness, when times were tough, when others were nervous about decision making, I found that kind of gray zone. That was my happy place. And I started stepping back and trying to figure out why. And that totally applies to the business world as well. And I came up with 9 principles that I found, and I really found this at the end of my career, which is really interesting. So it's all self-taught, but 9 principles that allowed me, to lead under times of adversity and to really have no fear in doing so and to have that confidence.
And like what, so out of that 9, let's say what's your top 3?
Oh, I struggle with this all the time because I love so many of these, but I'll start with kind of the first chapter.
Or we can go through them depending on how quick.
But if I tell you everything, no one will buy the book. So, you know,
and that's the thing too, is right. I know when I'm, it's like, I think the more sometimes that you do share from it, the more people are going to be intrigued to go read it because you're still getting that piece of it.
Sure.
And it's like, oh man, That's awesome. Well, what's about all this other stuff he's talking about? Because I definitely want to circle back here in a minute, talk a little bit about situational awareness and some things like that as well, too. But I'd love to hear kind of some of the points, and we don't have to go through all, but some of your top ones from your top nine.
My first principle, and I think that you know, and this resonates across all different you know, business sectors or anywhere, you know, even outside the world of special operations and intelligence, my old world. But I call it the glue guy or the glue gal, and that is the indispensable person behind the scenes. And so here I am as a CI case officer, you know, just like a Navy SEAL or a Green Beret, we're at the tip of the spear. You know, you're told you're a superstar, you know, you're part of this select few, you get all this incredible training, and you're off on a team, you know, and conducting an operation, conducting a mission. But don't ever forget, and I learned this, you know, the hard way, don't ever forget those indispensable individuals behind the scenes. So for in a CI operation, for example, if we're trying to capture a high value target, let's go back to the support officer who maybe, gave us the satellite imagery or the analyst who kind of prepped us beforehand, or even, and I talk about it in my book, even, you know, we had paramilitary bases in Afghanistan, our cook, literally the cook or the medics or the docs who made sure, you know, we had the right kind of nutrition and we were healthy. So when an operation would conclude and we'd all sit around and talk about how great we were all the time and everyone's thumping their chest, but you know what? I learned later on that you better celebrate those others behind the scenes,
right?
Because they are indispensable. And when you have to make decisions under pressure, under fire, if you know you have a team like that, complete with your door kickers, your case officers, your tip of the spear guys and gals, but also those support personnel, then you have a lot more confidence in doing so. You know, my stepbrother's an ER doc in Brooklyn. Mm. He struggled through COVID. It was unbelievable. And I write about him in my book because he said the nurses, that was their glue guy or glue gal, 100%. And so the doctor can save the patient. And the patient's like, oh, my God, doc, you know, I'll never forget what you've done for me. And he would say, well, hold on a second. What about everyone else behind the scenes? And so you have to embrace that. And I learned that later on in my career. But it's something that I think that people can really identify with.
Yeah, no, that's super important. And even like with a business, too, as you're growing and you're having that. I mean, we own a separate company here. And I mean, I think we employ, I don't know, 15 to 20 people. And I mean, the products wouldn't get made if it wasn't for them. It wouldn't get shipped out the door. And, you know, it's all stuff my wife used to do and things like that when it was first starting. But now we have those people and they're the ones that keep it moving, keep it running, keep it growing. And just like, you know, in that situation on a mission or things that you're doing, you have to rely on all those people and they got to be good at what they do and be able to deliver the correct items that you need to make you a success.
Right. I once gave this, you know, kind of a talk like this to a local high school football team. And there was, you know, there's a quarterback there. He's going off to play Division I football. And his name is Rye Yates. And I said, Rye, who's your glue guys? And he pointed to the table of offensive linemen. And they all started cheering and kind of piled on him. And I'm like, you guys got this. That's 100% right. So he's this stud dude going off to play Division I football. He's not doing any of that if these guys didn't protect him in the pocket the whole time. So,
and and like you said, that's important to have, you know, with that. So that was kind of one. What's one other really good one that you have on your list?
Sure. So, and this one I really think will resonate as well. And it's much more kind of business heavy. I actually did think about this in terms of, you know, taking what some folks in corporations did. And I call it employ the dagger, but that's the idea that competition is really good and healthy. And it's like, you know, what's the old Wall Street, you know, quote, greed is good. Well, my whole, you know, contention is that competition is really good. It does kind of drive everyone to do better. But there was a certain technique that I used to use. And it was whether it was in a big, you know, CI station or a small base. And it was called the stand up morning meeting. And when what I would do there is, I wouldn't tell people what I had to do, but I would ask them, what did you do last night? Now, at CIA, we work at night, whether you're meeting an agent, you know, a spy, maybe you're doing counter surveillance. You know, maybe you're writing up some of your reports, but you're always doing something. And then there's the one person as you go around the room and they said, you know, well, you know, I kind of took the night off. Now, sometimes that's okay, but I, as a leader, don't have to say anything. You know, if the peer pressure that says, okay, and you know what, if this person's busting their butt, got it, we'll give them a break. But if that happens a couple times, everybody else is going to look at them. And when I say employ the dagger, that just means, you know, use that kind of that, you know, that theory of competition, and that really pushes everyone to succeed. And then you have a high performance team, a team of kind of elite athletes or elite performers. So when, again, times are tough and you're like, okay, you know, the business climate is bad, or, you know, there's a high value target operation in my world. And you know, the weather's not right. We don't have correct surveillance. What do we do? you know that team you have is working at such a high performing performance that kind of, you know, the operations are go, or you can move forward. And I just really think that, you know, techniques like that, like a stand-up meeting, and I know it's been written about in the business world, but I really used it successfully, and I think it's a lot of, you know, really will resonate.
And that's super cool to hear you say that, because I mean that you've used that, you know, yeah, in, you know, while you're out on missions, you know, getting stuff set up, because it still translates over. It's, you know, whether it's a team in your business, and sure, you do your morning stand-up. We have one here every Monday with our, yep, manager team, and you know, wins and what they need help with and kind of things like that. And I mean, but what you also mentioned too, kind of employing that dagger is like Michael Jordan did that a lot. Like if you've seen Last Dance or listened to Tim Grover's new book, Winning, he talks about like how Jordan would always, and people like, oh man, he was a jerk and all that. But then afterwards they're like, well, he won 6 championships in a row because he also poked you to make sure that you were rising up to, right, trying to be at his level, even though you'll won't be, but getting you higher than where you would normally be.
Well, he made everyone better, and that, you know, that's the point. Yep. And I, you know, I use Michael Jordan as example, you know, for another principle of mine, which I call, you know, adversity is the performance enhancing drug to success, which means you have to fail first, and everybody does. And in my world of intelligence special operations, that happened all the time. And then I just point to Michael Jordan, who got cut from his high school basketball team.
You're right.
So, you know, and there's a lot of sports analogies in my book as well. And I talk a lot about baseball. Truth be told, I'm a huge, you know, Boston Red Sox fan. But I talk about in 2003 when they lost, you know, in this critical 7-game series to the Yankees. You know, Aaron Boone hit a home run in game 7. Well, the next year in 2004, they were down 3-0. And Kevin Millar, who was, you know, a Red Sox player, kind of came out and said, hey, we're going to shock the world. And then they won 4 straight. There's no way they win that year if they hadn't lost the year before.
Right.
And in the book, I use some examples, you know, from my world of intelligence operations. And it's you know, these are really kind of deep and emotional for me. And I talk about when I was in Iraq in 2003, I was running an agent, a spy, you know, and I pushed him too hard. He was giving us great, what we call order of battle information, which means it was disposition of Saddam Hussein's forces. And Washington was loving it, and I pushed him, and he got caught, and he got tortured, and he got executed. And that stayed with me because that was my fault. It was on me.
Sure.
Years later, in Afghanistan, I think this was 2012, we're going after a high-value target, actually someone who had killed a Taliban member who had killed 2 CIA officers. And so we wanted this guy. There was no doubt.
Right.
But I was much more patient, and we had recruited agents on the ground. We were going to, you know, put them on the X for either a capture or a kill mission. And I know this sounds really dramatic, you know, but this was my world. But ultimately, what happened is we waited and waited and waited, and I was super patient, much more patient than I was in the past. And we eventually took this Taliban member off the battlefield. And I remember that night we called from eastern Afghanistan, 6,000 miles away. We called back to Fort Bragg, North Carolina, the widow of one of our officers who had been killed several years earlier, and we told her that justice had been done. And so when I talk about, you know, adversity is the PED to success, my team wouldn't have had that success if I hadn't had that failure several years early and really learned from it. And it's just simple as that. It's learning from failure. Everybody fails.
Right.
You know, I mean, baseball, you're an all-star if you hit 300, but it's how you learn from that. And I think that that's a critical concept. And then so going forward to when you have to lead in times of adversity, if you have a team that you know has failed and learned from it, you're going to have so much more confidence in them.
Yeah, 100%. And I think like the key you said was you're learning from it and then you're making those changes moving forward. Because if you would have just rushed that last mission again,
yep, 100%.
Could have been in the same situation you were previous years before.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I tried to get forth in the book as well, and I hope that it kind of comes across today is, you know, For a lot of us in this weird type A world, you know, people think of many of us as having big egos, but actually it's the opposite. Like, I learned an incredible kind of dose of humility over the years. And I think that characteristic, that trait, humility, is really important because you can't believe your own hype. And, you know, in my world, in intelligence or spec ops, but certainly in the business world as well, like, it's tough, you know, it's unforgiving. And so, and yep, you know, you're going to have some tough times. And so having that sense, you know, don't believe your own hype, you know, having that sense of humility, I think, is really, really important.
Yeah. Yeah, no, definitely. Cause, it allows you to still operate and work with other people on your team. And you're not like, oh, hey, we got to look up to him. He's, you know, the top person. It's like, hey, cool, let's mesh, let's keep everything flowing and moving along. I want to kind of touch base. You mentioned earlier kind of a little bit about situational awareness and with all the craziness kind of that's been happening lately, and especially just even here in the U.S. I mean, what are some different things that you guys taught or when you were training somebody or that you did, one, to be more situationally aware? What were the things that you looked for? And then I'll kind of lead from there.
Sure. So one of the things that, I'll get to the point on this. It's one of my principles was called family values, and family values meaning having kind of this close knit team where everyone believed in each other, but it was much more than that. It was also the ability to communicate. And so I think communication is something, as a leader that is absolutely critical. So when you talk about, tough times now, the ability to run a team, but having people expect to be allowed to have input is critical. So when I see family values, that means, there's trust. And so, sure, I might be the boss, I might be the leader. I want input from everybody, and everybody gets a say. And I think that's critical now, especially in times where, there's so much uncertainty.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I know in your book, too, you talk a little bit about like clarity and crisis and everything. Kind of how does that all tie in with that? I mean, because obviously you can kind of take a look at, like Portland and different things, and there's a lot of crisis going on there. How do you break through and find that clarity and embrace what's happening and, stay safe and everything?
Sure. I would look at it. There's so much you can guide. We could talk for hours on this. So I would look at it in terms of individuals. So if you're talking about, I've talked to, I just did a show with a group of police officers out at the West Coast who are involved in a lot of this. And that's, that we really focused a lot on that. And so most of it, though, had to do with in times where there's that much adversity is how you take care of each other. It's that family values concept again. One of the things I really believe and I talk in is on wellness, is on the ability for people to take care of themselves. And so, the type A kind of world I lived in meant we drove everything really hard. But you also have to take time to step back. And that's where, there's a bit of the humility aspect too. But when you talk about running teams, and it's 2021. So what I would also do is everyone's got to have time, for proper kind of physical fitness. Nutrition is really important. And there's an element of privacy. You can't get into your employees, lives to a great extent, but you have to a little bit, because ultimately, high performing teams means, people's wellness is taken care of. Their family life is, as solid as can be. And so I really kind of believed in that. And that goes back to that principle I had on family values of kind of having that kind of respect. And I mean, I've been talking about in the book, having that, that love for each other. And so I think that really is critical when you have times, whereas if it's police officers in Portland, undergoing, incredible stress and uncertainty, those kind of principles really will resonate.
Yeah. And I mean, that applies back to, even over the last year with people in their businesses and being shut down and the massive amounts of stress and pressure and everything too. And I think you hit, some super good points is, taking care of yourself, try not to get out of those routines, eating healthy, keeping yourself, from a physically fit standpoint, still going about what you can go about with. And and pushing ahead and using that current situation to pivot to make those changes in your business and working with your team to be able to continue on wherever your goal is for that.
So there's one of my principles as well that I think that also will resonate here, and it's called Win an Oscar. And so what I talk about is kind of how you portray yourself as a leader, and I give some great examples of this. And I remember I was in Afghanistan. I was running a paramilitary base. I had the toughest, SOBs working for me. These were special operations veterans from, Tora Bora or Black Hawk down. We went out in a patrol. We came back. I was tired. And for the first time in months, I sat by myself in the mess hall, just by myself. I was tired. I didn't want to talk to him.
Right.
The base almost fell apart. Like, what's wrong with Mark? What's wrong with the boss? What's wrong with Chief? Why is he mad at us? These are the toughest people on the planet.
Yeah.
And I was like, what's wrong with you all? But then I kind of stepped back and said, okay, hold on a second. How you portray yourself as a leader really matters. And that's why I call it, winning an Oscar. And I love that example because, how you go about your business every day in front of your employees really does matter. And everyone's human. So, So, you know, you might have a bad day, you might snap at someone, but you got to correct that because everyone's looking at you as the boss and the leader. And particularly, again, in times of ambiguity, when times are tough, they're going to be looking at you on how you're reacting. I mean, there's so many great sports, you know, sports analogies on this. You know, a baseball manager, it's the bottom of the ninth inning that, you know, the team's down one or two runs, the whole team's looking at the manager. If that manager is kind of cool, calm, collected, you know, you're going to be all right. So I love that. I love that principle because I learned it from failing, actually. So, you know,
sure.
I like talking about it because I give that example.
No, that's fantastic.
Man, I hope you guys are really loving this episode of Making Bank. Tons of amazing information. And guys, if you're a small business entrepreneur, then this is for you. Obviously, you know, running a business is challenging. You have endless to-do lists, employees to take care of. Everybody wants your attention. And obviously, your bottom line, your profit. So first of all, kudos to you for staying on top of it, pushing through those challenges, and just really focusing on taking care of your employees and your customers. And I want to tell you about Gusto. Gusto built an easier and more affordable way to manage payroll, benefits, and more. They've helped over hundreds of thousands of businesses, even ours. Our business as well uses Gusto with tasks like automated payroll tax, filing simple direct deposits, free health insurance administration, 401ks, and cool onboarding tools. And you just name it, they got it. Gusto made it very easy. And they really care about the small business owners, the entrepreneurs like you that they work with. Their support team is attentive and very helpful. They help get us up and running smoothly and easily. And since money can be tight right now, you'll even get 3 months free once you run your first payroll. Check out Gusto. Just go to Gusto, GUSTO.com/makingbank and start setting up your business today. You'll see what I mean when I say easy, guys. 90% of the customers that switch to Gusto say it was very easy, and 85% of the customers running payroll, it's now even easier than their previous company that they've worked with. So again, guys, I'm super excited. They're giving you 3 months free of payroll at Gusto, GUSTO.com/makingbank.
I know we just got a few minutes left. One thing I just kind of wanted to put out for you and see what kind of response we get. Family, you know, everything we got going on right now. How do we keep all the crazy changes that's happening politically and everything else? How do we keep ourselves safe? How do we keep our family safe? How do we, you know, just kind of know, you know, kind of open our eyes up and keep us in that spot to, from a protection standpoint, and be able to protect our, you know, families as best we can? Because we got a lot of people that have families that watch this and everything.
Sure. Yeah. No. Of course. And, you know, that's an easy question. Right. So, you know, I think that, you know, the biggest thing now is you have to have, you know, I think that in the country, we've lost kind of that idea of respect for one another and respect for other people's opinions. And the country is so incredibly divided. You know, and I look at this and I'm sad because, you know, I spent so much time overseas and I really do believe kind of in the greatness of America. And there's no doubt that there's huge problems here in the United
sure.
States. But, you know, I also remember, you know, walking down the street at an embassy in the Middle East and seeing the American flag and seeing the silhouette and realizing that that meant a lot to a lot of people, especially, you know, people who actually wanted to come to America because we do stand for ideals. You know, the old kind of adage of America is this shining city on the hill. Like, I still believe that through all this. I still believe America is a great country. So, you know, I think that, you know, you start at the local level. You start with what you can control. So be kind to your neighbors, be kind to your friends and family, even if they disagree with you politically.
Sure.
You know, don't react. You know, people get so emotional on certain issues. You know, social media is, and I'm just as guilty on Twitter, social media is a nightmare because people can kind of, you know, spew so much hate on that. But it's just, you know, there's got to be kind of a return to civility and kindness. And of course, look, you have to protect your families. I mean, it's the kind of thing where you have to just, I caution my kids on their use of social media as well. And, you know, I mean, I don't want to kind of go down the road in terms of, you know, things like, you know, gun ownership and stuff like that. But you got to be able to protect your, you know, protect your house, protect your home. If you want to do that, that's fine. But you know, but ultimately it's just trying to be kind of better human beings to each other. And I think that's something that we've really lost. And I hope that we kind of get that back, because as someone who has been outside this country for so long and fought for this country, you know, you look inside and you're like, you know, we're still okay.
Right.
There's some warning signs. And you just want to really kind of return to that kind of era of civility, even if you have political differences.
For sure.
So that's what I hope for.
Awesome. No, that's great. And I think that's super important. And it all has to start kind of with you and your neighbor and the people that are around you and everything, you know, and that's how you get that grassroots, you know, change or continuation of,
right,
you know, where you want to go. So.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I mean, I came from a really kind of tough world where everyone had these kind of huge type A personalities, but you know, you can be kind to one another. You know, I'll never forget, my mom died when I was in Afghanistan. And I remember I had to fly back to the United States, and our helicopter pilots are some of the best in the world. And we're trying to get me back through Eastern Afghanistan all the way back to Kabul. And we're going through some bad weather. And I remember we're hovering in this mountain pass, and I'm on comms telling these guys to turn around, and they didn't. And we landed another base ultimately so I could get back. And you know, I went up to the pilots as we're, you know, after we landed, and I said, "Hey, that was too dangerous. Why'd we do that?" And he said, you know, I was the boss. I said, "You know, hey, chief, look, we know your mom died, and we're getting you back home to bury her." And so I tell this story because how can I not have kind of love and affection for those people I served with? Sure. These are other Americans, and you know, that can translate to the rest of the country as well. There are good people out there. Yep. And so we just kind of got to get back to that kind of feeling.
Fantastic. So one last thing, I mean, one question you're like, man, I was hoping Josh was going to ask me this today, but he didn't. So I really want to just share it with everybody before we wrap up here.
Sure. One last question for me. Wow. So, I mean, I think I would hope, and I'd be really excited to kind of take my book and my principles to the business world. You know, I wrote it, and it's super, you know, heavy on according to Intel and special operations. Tons of analogies to kind of baseball and the sports world. But I think in the private sector, the entrepreneurial sector, you know, I would love to, you know, to come out. And so, you know, I welcome everyone kind of reaching out to me. Certainly, I'd love them to buy the book. But I want to go out and talk about it and speak about it. And in my book, there's a checklist for each principle. You know, I call it the Mad Minute, and where you can actually apply these principles to your life or whatever, you know, business or profession you're having. So I look forward to kind of interacting the American people. And so I would ask them to just, you know, send me an invite, and I'll come their way.
Awesome. Well, Mark, thank you for your time today, guys. I hope you guys were taking notes. If not, go back, watch, listen to this again, and listen to what Mark is saying. He's through his different stories and some of the different things that we spoke about. There's a lot of amazing things that you guys can take right now, apply to your personal life, to your business, your leadership and your team at your business, and even with your family. And start implementing it right now, and you know, taking in that information and applying it. You got to take action on what he talked about, not just listen and watch this. So, Mark, again, thank you for coming on Making Bank. Really appreciate your time today. And then just let people know, where's the best place to get the book at?
So it's Clarity in Crisis: Leadership Lessons from the CIA. It's on Amazon right now. It came out today. Today's the publication date, so I'm super excited. But it's at Barnes & Noble. You can get it. You know, anywhere else. If you go, clarityincrisisbook.com is the landing page. I'm excited. So thanks for having me on today. Love
for sure.
Thanks.
Yeah, definitely. Guys, hit the links below, grab a copy of Mark's book. Like I said, I've dove into it a little bit already, and tons of amazing content just for you guys. So I am Josh Felber. You were watching Making Bank. Get out and be extraordinary.
Thank you for listening to Making Bank. If you have enjoyed this episode, please leave a review. And sharing is caring. Follow Josh Felber on Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram for more. You can also listen to Making Bank on Amazon Alexa, Spotify, iHeartRadio, and watch on Apple TV, Success Thinkers Network, Amazon Fire, and YouTube.